Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. Welcome to yet another exciting show. Now, I wrote in my book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck, that we are all basically large wounded children. Now, I mean that about our general maturity level in dealing with a lot of things, but the reality is there are some of us who still, as adults, have lives that revolve a little too much around, Mommy, don't leave me. Now, my guest tonight, therapist Dr. Michelle Skeen, is here to talk about why that is and how to dig yourself out of this behavior. Her book we're discussing is Love Me, Don't Leave Me, Overcoming Fear of Abandonment and Building Lasting Loving Relationships. Hello, Michelle. Michelle, are you on? Let me just see if you're live. Oh, Michelle is not live. Let me just put Michelle's microphone live. I'm sorry. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I wanted to talk about your book because it is just, it's so good. It's so practical, and I find that so few self-help books are. And you start out with our childhood experiences. You say that our childhood experiences create our story. Tell us what that means.
Well, what it means is that, well, in terms of the fear of abandonment, we're all born with that fear. It's primal. If we're not taken care of when we're born, if we're abandoned, we will cease to exist. So it makes sense that we have that fear. And I've identified four other fears that work in concert with fear of abandonment to get in the way of our relationships. And go ahead.
Oh, sorry. We'll get to those. But I wanted to talk a little bit before just about some of the dynamics. And you say that people find themselves drawn to very similar relationship dynamics and environments that they experienced as a child.
Sometimes they are. I mean, sometimes they're drawn to them, and then sometimes they avoid them. So I think that we can see people who just opt out of relationships. And now I think women are able to disguise that as well as men have been in the past with successful careers. So it can look like they're successful and happy and functioning at a high level, but they're avoiding the one aspect of their lives that is really painful for them and that they associate with fear.
That is very interesting. Do the women who are doing this, do you think most of them know they're doing this, or do they think that it's just all about their career and they don't see the other?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends upon how deep they are in their distraction, and I'm sure on some level they know it, but as with all of us, we try to avoid painful experiences, thoughts, emotions, feelings, so a lot of times it's just deeply buried.
And now your book focuses a lot around abandonment. And can you tell us a little bit about how the stage gets set for fear of abandonment?
The stage can get set in a number of ways. So in the book, as I'm sure you noticed, there are some numerous examples of what the situation can look like that creates a fear of abandonment. But first, one of the things that we look at is temperament. So, and this is all about nature and nurture, right? So what kind of temperament are you born with? And how does that interact with your primary caregiver. And so we quickly look at attachment styles. As you know, there's a lot of detailed literature about that and books that very specifically deal with attachment styles and attachment issues. And I touch on it because what I wanted to do in this book was to lightly touch on the source of this fear and not spend a lot of time dwelling on it, because the point is to move beyond it and learn how to deal with it and get to a healthy, happy place in relationships. So if you have an avoidant attachment.
Oh, well,
then,
let me just backtrack and explain to people that attachment is the relationship a child has with their primary caregiver. And
exactly.
So, and you write about these different styles. There's secure attachment. We've talked about these before on the show. Secure attachment is the healthy kind. There's avoidant attachment and ambivalent attachment. So tell us first what secure attachment is. That's the good kind.
Yeah, the secure attachment is when the child seeks out the caregiver for comfort when a situation is distressing, because she knows that the caregiver will comfort her and make her feel better. And the child is confident that the caregiver is always available to her. The child is excited when the caregiver returns, and the child's accepting of and comforted by the caregiver. So that's what a secure attachment looks like. And
that can sound a little bit like helicopter parenting, but it's not. It's when the child is, it's when they really are.
Their early years.
Right, their early years. It's not that they're, they're 10.
Yeah, this isn't in high school.
They're still breastfeeding, right.
And
so take us through avoidant attachment, the primary caregiver who is rejecting and harsh.
Right. The caregiver isn't a secure base, and so the child can be aggressive toward the caregiver or more clingy and demanding in the home environment than the securely attached child. And the child can show no interest in the caregiver when she returns, even though the child was distressed when the caregiver left. And so this child really cannot consistently rely on their caregiver. And as you might imagine, that's very unsettling.
Yeah, you can see how that would mess a person up. And now ambivalent attachment, that's the chaotic environment for the child.
Right. And this is a child who's overtly anxious. They're clingy and demanding in the home environment, and they're upset when the caregiver leaves and wants the caregiver desperately when he or she returns, even though the child is inconsolable.
And so you say that the children with the secure attachment, the ones who have the caregiver who's there for them when they cry and they hurt their knee or otherwise need the caregiver, that they're more flexible in their thinking. So interesting. And you say resulting in the ability to manage their impulses and desire more than the anxiously attached. So that's really interesting how that plays out in adulthood, whether your mom was really, or your dad, whether they were available to you when you needed them emotionally.
Yeah, and I think that where things can change for the securely attached child, because for women who are listening, they're saying, I was a securely attached child. I had a secure caregiver. A lot of times what messes with that is like a big rupture. And as, some of the stories I tell in the book, like a bad divorce of the parents that leaves the child feeling kind, even in late adolescence, this can happen, or the sudden death of a parent. So there are other ways that it doesn't just have to be that you had this unhealthy attachment early on. It could be that you had a healthy attachment, but then you had some sort of trauma that left you feeling like the world is not a safe place and that you cannot count on your loved one being there because they might just disappear, your family ruptures, or again, you know, death of a parent.
Yeah, I see more and more actually that stability is so important in those in your formative years, and mm-hmm. that it really, I can see what you're talking about for a teen, somebody who's going through this. Now, you write about, I guess they're called schemas. Oh, and I should say my show is, the audience is both men and women. It seemed like maybe your book was written a bit for more of a female audience, but I think it's good for, you know, anybody who has these issues. And I should say who I'm talking to. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Michelle Skeen, and her book we're discussing is Love Me, Don't Leave Me, Overcoming Fear of Abandonment and Building Lasting Loving Relationships. So is it schemas or schemas?
It's schemas, and the framework that I used for the book comes from schema therapy, and a schema is a core belief that develops as a result of our childhood and adolescent experiences, and it informs the way that we view ourselves, others, and the world around us. And this is all of this is applicable to men who are also have this fear of abandonment. One of the reasons that I did gear the book, just to address your comment, toward women is because it was simply going to be more complicated to write the book for both genders. And I think that it can manifest slightly differently in men, and but it can be very useful for a man. All of the exercises in the book and the assessments and everything can be used by a man. It's just that everything is in kind of a traditional, you know, talking about a woman and referring to her relationship with men. So again, it can also work for women who are lesbians or have other types of relationships.
So these core beliefs, these are emotional states and ways of coping. And you describe four in addition to abandonment. So I'll just go through them and then I'll have you talk about them. There's abandonment, and then there's mistrust and abuse, emotional deprivation, defectiveness, and failure. So you say those are the four beliefs that trigger the fear of abandonment. So I think we know what abandonment is. Take us through mistrust and abuse.
So if you have a mistrust and abuse core belief, these statements will resonate with you. I always get hurt by the people close to me. People will take advantage of me if I don't protect myself. People I trusted have verbally, physically, or sexually abused me. And this core belief can trigger abandonment, or abandonment can trigger this core belief. We all have core beliefs, and one of the important aspects of this book is to try and eliminate any shame associated with having these core beliefs. We all have probably more than one. And what I've found in my practice and even, you know, with friends is that there are usually two that kind of work in concert. And I found that to be particularly true with the abandonment core belief. And so, you know, the way that this may play out is that someone might even feel like they have to tolerate abuse from in any form from a partner, or they will be left. So they may surrender to that kind of relationship so that they won't be left. So that's one dynamic that can play out there.
I want to go on to the next one, but I wanted to go back to, you have this great description of core beliefs as a framework that helps organize and make sense of information and things around us. And you talk about how this helps us predict our present and future experiences. And so what you're saying there about how we're going to react in the present, you know, if we've had this mistrust and abuse core belief, that makes a lot of sense, that we're going to see things are going to be colored by that past, our past experience.
Right. And it's also kind of, you know, it's predictive, but it's also protective, right? I mean, we are designed to be more drawn to the negative than the positive because of the way that we're wired. And in the past, something negative could mean that we would die, you know, that we would get eaten by that big lion. Or so we're more on alert for that. And so it's a good thing, but it's not good when you let it get in the way of developing healthy relationships and being happy in your life.
And we'll get on to the ways that you give, the advice you give for how to deal with this. I want to move on to emotional deprivation, that core belief. Tell us about that.
Right. So if you have emotional deprivation, you may have thoughts like, I feel lonely, I don't get the love that I need, I don't have anyone in my life who really cares about me or meets my emotional needs, I don't feel emotionally connected to anyone. So just that idea of not being seen or not being, you know, valued and appreciated and loved in a way that you want to be loved.
Now, what if that's true? Because some people behave in antisocial ways, and maybe that's true that they don't. You talk later in the book about listening and people, how to be a good listener, the people who just talk and don't listen and don't have good friendships. So where is that line drawn, and how do you help patients with that?
Well, I think that if you go into a relationship with the expectation that they're not going to get you, they're not going to love you the way you need to be loved, you know, it's a setup. You know, it'll end up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're going to try and trip people up, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And so you're going to have these reinforcers. Oh, see, it happened again. Like, he didn't care about me the way I should be cared about. So one of the big pieces is to, in this book, is this self-knowledge piece. You really need to get kind of down and dirty with yourself and really admit to how you feel and what you might be doing that is creating this situation, that's bringing your past into the present. So maybe that did happen with your dad, or maybe that happened to you with your mom, but what are you doing now that's continuing that?
I see.
And
what you're
not
saying.
It's not about blame. It's just about trying to take control of what you can. You know, there are many things that are out of our control, but I also believe there are a lot of things that are in our control. And so a really honest self-assessment is important.
Yeah, and just to describe what you were saying, I see what you're saying as it's somebody who goes in predicting a behavior rather than observing it. So it's not what's necessarily going on. They're expecting it.
Well said.
And so defectiveness core belief. Tell us about that.
Right. So those thoughts are going to be, if people really knew me, they would reject me. I'm unworthy of love. I feel shame about my thoughts. I present a false self because if people saw the real me, they wouldn't like me. So often in this situation, if they're, as you start to get close to someone and they seem to like you and everything's going well and they want to get to know you better, that can trigger this, oh my gosh, they're going to see me for who I really am, and then they're going to leave me. They're going to reject me.
And so that's that
link with abandonment.
And then the last one you give of these four that are connected to the abandonment core belief is the failure core belief. Tell us about that one.
Right. And that's the belief that most of my peers are more successful than I am. I'm not as smart as other people in my life. I feel ashamed that I don't measure up to others. I don't possess any special talents. So often these people can feel like maybe they'll be, the person they're with will see someone who is more successful, who's more whatever, and will abandon them for someone who is more successful.
So something that's very important is this self-assessment. In your book, Love Me, Don't Leave Me, you have this very good chapter. I like it because it's checkboxes and not a lot of stuff to write for most of it. This what do I believe, assessing your core beliefs. So talk a little bit about that, about why this is so important to just to take stock and how that's done.
Well, I think that I think a lot of people like assessments. They like taking little questionnaires, whether it's the Myers-Briggs or, you know, some of those other things that say, oh, you're this type of person. This isn't quite as cheery in that, I mean, the outcome can be cheery, but it's not like you're saying, oh, this is so awesome. I have a mistrust and abuse core belief. But it is the step, it is an important step that will get you closer to recognize, to bringing to consciousness what is going on with you so that you can address the proper issues so that you can move forward and leave this, deal with this and leave this in the past and not bring your past so into the present.
I saw this chapter as very positive because you need to identify what's wrong to fix it. And you really just drew all this stuff out. I really like that. I don't like a lot of writing in books. So I like that it was mostly check this, you know, okay, you feel you're a loser. I mean, it wasn't quite that. But talk a little bit about, you have this example of a snow globe to explain what it's like when your core beliefs, and these are the things, mistrust and abuse, abandonment, emotional deprivation, defectiveness, failure, when these things get triggered, that what happens?
Well, it's like taking a snow globe and shaking it, and it gets activated. And that's what it feels like when your core belief gets triggered. You're activated. Everything is everything is right there. You're often just completely overwhelmed with negative thoughts and painful emotions, and we have an automatic reaction to behave in a way that will get rid of that. And that's usually a behavior that's not helpful.
And you say it's usually a behavior from the past, and you use this term, I love this, I hadn't heard of this term called old tapes. Reacting to a person as if they are your parent. So reacting to memories rather than the reality in the moment. And that was fascinating.
Well, it is such a powerful link. I mean, just think about little things, like when you catch a whiff of something that smells so familiar and all of a sudden you say, oh my gosh, that reminds me of the chocolate chip cookies that my mom used to bake every Friday when I was growing up. You know, those kind of, it's really easy for us to have experiences that kind of transport us to the past. And if we're in a familiar situation and we've already been trained to expect a particular outcome, we're just going to start predicting. We're going to skip the whole part where it plays out. We're just going to go to the conclusion. We're going to fast forward through that movie. Oh, I already saw this part. I remember this. Let me just get to the end here and be done with this. I'll skip the part where I cry. I liked using the snow globe metaphor because I also wanted to give people an idea of where to put that experience from their past that keeps cropping up in their present, so that they could put it there and then they could have this image in their head when they get emotionally activated that, oh, that's my, you know, that's my snow globes being shaken right now. You know, the snow is falling on that scene, but that's a frozen scene. That's a scene from the past. It's not present day. So it's starting to ease the reader into, you know, present moment mindfulness activities.
We will get to mindfulness, but I just wanted to talk about how we tend to react to these things from a very primal level. You talk about our fight, flight, or freeze reactions, and these are old adaptations and not the most mature reactions for an adult world in 2014.
Right. So, but part of me explaining this in the book is, again, to try to take some of the shame away that the reader's feeling. Because, look, if you've been trapped in these cycles for a long time, you don't feel good about yourself. I mean, it's it helps to understand that a lot of this is just natural. It's our natural drive, right? I mean, the like you said, the fight, flight, or freeze response is something that's hardwired in us and that really worked out well when we were back roaming the land and we had to, you know, hunt for our own food and worry about getting gobbled up by wild animals or other people. So it all makes sense, but now, and I think you probably see this too, so often I see people, I mean, I know people who don't want to get involved in an intimate relationship again because they were so hurt from a past relationship that even though it didn't kill them, they're still alive, it was painful. Does it feel good to get dumped or have your heart broken or have things not work out after you've put your heart out there and your time into it? It absolutely doesn't feel good. But, you know, I just want to encourage people that this is one of the most fabulous things about being alive on this planet is that we get to have the opportunity to have really amazing connections with other people, and that's something that you shouldn't eliminate from your life because you're afraid that you're going to get hurt and you're reacting like you're going to be killed when, you know, like you're avoiding death, when really it's maybe you're going to have a little bit of heartache. But if you're going about it properly and you're behaving properly and it doesn't work out, I feel like at the end, it's nice to be able to look back and say, well, I feel good about how I handled this. And even if that's where someone gets after reading this book, that's really important because it doesn't feel as hurtful. You know, it feels worse to get to the end of a situation and have regrets about how you behaved or what you could have done differently. So I don't know. I love love. I mean, I really am a love person. I really want to encourage people to try to be in relationships and develop relationships, and they don't all last forever, but there's a lot to be learned from them.
And along the lines of what you were saying before the show, we were talking about Albert Ellis, who is he was the co-founder of cognitive behavioral therapy with Aaron Beck, and he talks about awfulizing, and that's when people say, oh my God, it would be so horrible if this person dumped me. Well, mm-hmm. You prefer that they wouldn't, and it wouldn't be fun, and you'll be eating some ice cream and crying and hiding behind your couch. But no, you're not going to be, a claw is not going to come up from under the earth and drag you down to hell for the rest of eternity. And so you talk about this in your book, about spelling things out. What really goes on? Okay, this is what will happen if this person breaks up with me or leaves me. And I know that this, you know, we do go back to these sort of childhood things. I was going to tell a story before just about my mother. She's just always late to pick me up. I'd be at the community center after ballet. I was probably six. You know, I thought, don't you care that someone's going to kidnap me and throw me in a hole or something like that? And she'd arrive, you know, the place would be closing up. And so, and my boyfriend, who is my producer, is very sweet and picks me up at the airport, and he's always waiting there in the baggage claim. But, you know, there have been one or two times there's been a traffic jam or something, he's not there. And it really presses those buttons, those childhood buttons of like, No one loves me. They don't care if I'm kidnapped. I mean, you just go to that
right.
place that, you know, the large wounded child place I described in the show opening.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, you recognize that. You know that's happening. And you know where that comes from. So that's really powerful. And that's the whole point of the book, too. If you can make that link, and then if you can catch yourself in the moment and say, wait, but Greg, is Greg the guy? Is
yes,
Greg your boyfriend?
Greg. Yes.
Yeah, you can say, wait, but Greg's always there for me. Yeah, I'm thinking this. This is related to my mom. This has nothing to do with Greg. That's a huge step, right? And to
right.
even be able to say that out loud, hey, sweetheart, like I just had this thought, like you don't care about me because you were late. And then I was thinking, oh, my gosh, that's my mom. That's not Greg. And, you know, and then he can say, yeah, sweetheart, I'm always there for you. And you can say, yeah, I know you are. And, you know, you have a moment of, you know, recognizing what's going on with yourself and sharing it with your partner and having him acknowledge that, yes, there's, I can understand why you'd think that, but that's great. You get the difference. That's huge.
Oh, no, I do know. I do. I know. And actually, I don't think I probably ever said anything to him. He's always there for me. But
well,
maybe
now
one
you have.
Time. You're right. Yeah. Hi, honey. He wrote, never mind, I'm not allowed to say on Skype, when did I not pick you up? No, he picked me up just one time, maybe just late.
He's texting you now.
12 years, right? No, and just pushing his buttons. This is a perfect lead into mindfulness. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Michelle Skeen. Her very helpful book we're discussing is Love Me, Don't Leave Me, Overcoming Fear of Abandonment and Building Lasting Loving Relationships. So mindfulness, tell us first what mindfulness is.
Well, mindfulness is being in the moment, observing the moment, being aware of what's happening in the moment. And before I continue that, can I just say that as an example of what you were talking about with you and Greg, now imagine if you didn't recognize the connection and when, if he was ever late, but when he was late, that you were very upset and you said, this is just, you're never there for me. I can't be with someone who isn't, you know, like you had a reaction that would have been understandable in your past situation, but wasn't appropriate in the moment, that you can see how quickly that could sabotage a relationship, because maybe he just gets really offended and says, are you kidding? This is, you're saying this to me? I'm always there for you. What are you talking about? It escalates, and pretty soon you've demolished a relationship that was good.
I can see exactly. So the person, and this isn't our relationship, but that, you know, the person would feel unappreciated. And rightfully so, you know, you're reacting to, Mom, you didn't pick me up at the community center, except Mom now shaves, you know, and
right.
takes you on dates. And it's just, that's why one of the things I love about your book is this mindfulness orientation where it's, look, pay attention to the now. I've written some columns. I've written about mindfulness meditation, which is very helpful for people who are addicts to start to have
mm-hmm.
feel their feelings, to have training wheels to that, to get comfortable with discomfort, which is something you talk about. And this
yeah.
is just this thing, and you explain it very simply in your book about how to just do these things. I like the points where you talk about cultivating daily awareness. Just pay attention. Is your coffee hot? What's the milk taste like? These things that we just let fly by us without paying attention, and that you bring that awareness then to your relationship is basically what you're saying.
Yeah. You're actually with the person you're with, and you haven't transformed the person you're with into someone from your past. And
yeah.
And that's really important. And, yeah, the mindfulness, just a quick mention. I had someone on my show, there's mindfulness for addiction is, you know, it's an amazing protocol. I mean, mindfulness is great for everything. We all need to be more mindful. We all need to be more in the moment. We're always, you know, we're ruminating about the past and we're worrying about the future and spending very little time in the moment.
I wanted to just mention, I had a therapist on my show, Dr. Andrea Brandt, who talked about how she would just do this mindfulness meditation. This is this thing where you just, you lie down and you think about, oh, there's my toes, I feel my toes, I feel my legs. Mm-hmm. It's being there in the moment, that she would do it for just a few minutes. You could do it for like 3 minutes at the end of the day. And I always thought, oh, I don't have time to meditate. But actually, this end of the day thing, when your brain's kind of shut off, that's a great time for it, and has so many health benefits and relationship benefits, and just making you a better person, a less, you know, automatically reactive person, that it seems really important to do just maybe 3 times a week, 3 minutes.
I think that people think that mindfulness is something that it's not. And I think that a lot of us thought it was where you had to clear your mind of everything and you had to just sit and have a clear mind, and everyone with all of the stimulation in our lives are like, how can I clear my mind for even a few seconds? But really, you want me to do this for 5 minutes? It's not about clearing your mind at all. Turns out, it's not about clearing your mind at all. It's about being aware of what's going through your mind, and even and dealing with everything equally and with the same kind of observation, like, oh, that's interesting, I'm having this negative thought that I'm on a radio show and I might run out of things to say. Oh, now I'm having a really nice thought about how pleasant this is to talk to Amy. You know, that you don't cling on to any of the thoughts, even the positive thoughts. You let all of them just kind of go through you and just observe them. And just like you observe everything and don't get stuck on things. And so, you know, big part of this journey that this book is designed to take people on is to get you unstuck from dwelling on negative thoughts, unstuck from engaging in unhelpful behaviors, unstuck from these, you know, the story, your old story, the story of your past. It's not your present. That's what happened to you. And, you know, none of us go through childhood and adolescence unscathed. It's not an indictment on our parents. It's not an indictment on peers. It is what happens. We are going through life. We're all going to have unpleasant experiences. And depending upon our temperament and our kind of predisposition to life, some of that mess is going to get on us. And we're going to have feelings about ourselves and others based upon these little, they can even be little toxic experiences that we had. You know, think about your, you know, I was thinking about like early childhood memories. You know, you're thinking, what's my earliest childhood memory? It almost doesn't matter. We have these unconscious memories, right? We have something, we somehow have imprinted these experiences have imprinted on us, right? And so we all have kind of our ways of reacting to certain situations. People that trigger me may not trigger you. You may find that we could go out together and you'd say, oh, he was so delightful. And I'd say, oh my gosh, he was a nightmare. You know, we're all kind of different that way, right? Depending upon what our experiences have been, we're going to have different reactions to situations or people, dynamics.
Absolutely. And you described that so beautifully about meditating. I just want to reinforce that. I love this, you don't have to be good at this. This is why I didn't meditate before, because I'm a crappy meditator. And so This is okay. Even if you're distracted, you just observe that you're distracted. It isn't
exactly bad.
Because what you're supposed to do is non-judgmentally observe your thoughts. Mm-hmm. I wrote about this in a column. I said it's like there's scenes you're passing in the car. And so if you can't focus on your knee, then you're focusing on not focusing, and that's okay. And as you talk about taking out the shame, and I should say who I'm speaking with, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Michelle Skeen. Her book we're discussing is Love Me, Don't Leave Me, Overcoming Fear of Abandonment and Building Lasting, Loving Relationships. Now, something I really respect in your book is that it is values-oriented, and you talk about values as motivation for change. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that we recognize is that, so we've gotten to the part where, okay, I recognize I have these unhelpful behaviors and I might be sabotaging my relationships. I don't want to do that. I'll try not to do it. Okay. You know, just like I'm going to try not to have some sugary treat this week. Okay. You know, and then by Friday, I'm like, never mind. It's Friday. I'm going to have a sugary treat. So what keeps you on track for more helpful behavior? Well, the same kind of thing that keeps me on track for not eating junk is I get on the scale and weigh myself, and that helps guide me. So in terms of behavior like this in relationships, what is designed to guide the person is for them to come in contact, identify, and embrace their values. And that sounds really easy, but as you and I discussed earlier, it's really difficult sometimes to dig those values up. You know, we get so busy, we're so buried in our problems or challenges or work or family or kids that, like, unconsciously we might know them, but it makes such a difference to bring them to conscious awareness so that when you are challenged and you're facing like a moment of decision, you're having some really experiencing some really uncomfortable emotions, some real negative thoughts, and you need to make a choice about you're going to go back to this old behavior that hasn't gotten you where you wanted to be, or you're going to look at engaging in some new behaviors, then you look at your values, and it's easy to make the choice. The values are commitment to living a way that is going to bring us closer to our goals in life. They identify things that we care about, and I think it's a really great motivator, and it's really great for everyone, even if people are listening to your show and they're not dealing with any of the fears that I discuss in my book. Everyone should take a reassessment of their values and just kind of look at, you know, I find this true for even people who are just working so hard and they're just buried and they're not doing anything else and they're exhausted and they're unhappy and their relationships are suffering. What are your values? Like, what do you care about? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, now maybe that sounds ambiguous, but you do something that I thought was really great. Page 92, well, I have a review copy. I have the uncorrected galley, but so maybe it's a little different in the book, but identifying your values. And you did this very wise thing, which is just you listed all these words like resolve, resilience, kindness, learning, assurance, attentiveness, excitement, family, faith. So people can actually just go through and think about these things, commitment, compassion, competence, what is important to you? And if you identify that, that's something when I get letters from people, I write an advice column, as most people know who are listening, and some of these letters, I think, if this person just had values, if they had standards, if they knew what they were, they could answer their own question. And I don't want to be out of a job, so, and I don't think I will be anytime soon, but
Even when people identify their values, they still need guidance from people like you. And, you know, that list is, thank you for pointing that out. It's not exhaustive, but it's meant to just get people thinking about, you know, if you, let's say you identify health as one of your values and you're 60 pounds overweight, you need to get in touch with your value, right? That's something you value that you've lost sight of. You know, if acceptance is one of your values and you're really, you know, critical of yourself and others, then that's another thing to look at. So I think it's, you know, even writing the book and knowing all of this, going through it again, it's always nice to reconnect, even if you think you are living it. And it's great to look at when you're at a point of making a decision. You know, it could be a life decision. It could be a relationship decision. It's a great guiding factor.
Yeah, I think that that's very true. This is why your book, even if you don't have a problem with abandonment, I thought that these were very helpful tools to look at your values and just what you were talking about before with the sweet treat. Scott Adams, who actually is a, I love that, I have a sweet tooth, but Scott Adams, who's actually a Dilbert cartoonist, he wrote in a book, and I had him on the show, about goals versus systems, and I thought about mm-hmm. that as you were saying that. If your system, he said goals, you know, they're depressing because you hit your goal and then, you know, there's nothing left, or if
right.
you miss your goal, then you suck, you know, that's what we tend to
right.
think. But he said if you have a system, if your system is, well, I want to be healthy, then even if you have a sweet treat on Friday, you try not to do that, you don't give yourself permission to just, you know, screw your goals, but then, you know, it's just one little bump in the general system, and that you have, you're going for that overall, and so you don't feel maybe the sense of shame, which you talk about as being so damaging, we know is damaging, where if you just, your goal, you know, you tanked your goal for that Friday.
Well, I think that, the values, so that people understand, very much like what you're talking about with the systems versus goals, values can get you to your goals, but you never achieve your values. You live your values, whereas you can achieve your goals. You never achieve your values. They are a constant for you. They are they're your journey. The goals are your destination, but you're constantly on a journey.
Now, we have this nasty person inside us, our inner critic. Tell us mm-hmm. about our inner critic.
Well, yeah, the inner critic is really trips people up a lot. And I think that most of us are more critical of ourselves than we are with someone else. Although I find, you know, it's interesting for me because I find when I start to feel like I'm having critical thoughts about other people, that it's really something that I'm upset with about myself, and so that I need to turn it inward and see what's really going on. But what I find with people who are struggling with these relationship issues, they are often have like an inner dialogue, especially when they're just starting to date someone, or they're in a situation, maybe it's a familiar situation for them and they get triggered, that they can quickly turn the situation into thoughts of these predictive thoughts, right? Don't trust him. He's going to leave you. Everyone leaves you. Don't tell him who you really are. Tell him your innermost thoughts. He will find you, you know, flawed and won't want to be with you. And so I think that it's just about learning how to deal with those thoughts and not get stuck on them. Again, you know, back to the mindfulness, right? Okay, I'm having that thought. And getting kind of detached from the good thoughts and the bad thoughts. Again, you're just observing, that's familiar. I always have that thought when I'm going out on a first date or, so I think that, again, you're never going to get, you know, there used to be all of these tools to how you get rid of a negative thought. Oh, just replace it with a positive thought. And it doesn't work like that. You can't just take a negative thought that says, oh, he's going to leave you, and replace it with, he's going to stay with you and love you forever and have that work. So instead, you just have to learn to accept it. This is just part of your life. Just like so many things in our world are just things that we deal with that are there, you know, trash on the sidewalk or, you know, I don't know, pollution or whatever. It's just stuff that's around, and you have to take a different approach to it. And self-compassion is a huge piece that I think so many people ignore. You know, we're so much more compassionate toward other people than we are ourselves. And a mentor and friend of mine who works with narcissists suggests for the therapist who's working with the narcissist, who can so often be challenged by a person like that, that they have them bring in a photo of themselves as a child, so that the therapist can remember that this guy who's a pain in the ass was a child once, and was a child who was hurt, and that's why he's like this now. And so I suggest in my book that the reader do that for themselves. Go find a photograph of yourself when you were a child and look at that and imagine yourself saying all of those negative things to that child. You wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I thought that was a great beat yourself up. A great suggestion. And I just wanted to explain, you were talking about how it does not work when you try to suppress your thoughts. And there's research by the late Daniel Wegner, Don't Think of the White Bear. And this is the worst thing, because it makes your mind sweep around to see if you've thought about the white bear, which is thinking about the white bear, which means that you failed. And so you suggest ways of diffusion that work better than fighting to make your thoughts go away. I thought these were excellent. You talked just a bit ago about watching your thoughts. And then you say labeling and naming your thoughts. So tell us a little bit about why that is helpful.
Well, I think that we all have thoughts that, again, originate with these past toxic experiences that are getting in the way of our present-day relationships. So in the case of, I don't want to get you and Greg in any trouble, but just going back to that situation, if you're having this thought that you're going to be left, then you can, you know, you label that and say, oh, that's from when, or that you're not going to be picked up, or that you're not worthy of being picked up, is that thought that you're having is from your past with your mom. So you might say, oh, that's mom. Or you might say, oh, or you might label that, oh, that's from, you know, daycare, from when I was at daycare or whatever. So that you are really conscious of what these thoughts are related to. And again, that they're not related to the present day experience. So that...
Actually, I have to say that works. And actually, my little sister, Carolyn, and I both do this, that, you know, there have been times that I've been in Michigan, or she has, or one of us has picked the other up from the airport. And we both just identify that. And you know, that I feel if I'm left at the airport, I become that little girl at the Farmington Community Center who's, you know, going to be kidnapped and no one cares. But I totally identify that. And so I can laugh at it and understand why I'm behaving that way, that it has nothing to do with my very sweet sister or my very sweet boyfriend who, you know, are always people who really show that they care about you. That's why nobody likes to be treated unfairly. It's a big bugaboo with us. And so when someone gets treated, when they get the brunt of that mommy was late for me 400 times or however many times you get picked up as a kid, you know, because one time, like, you know, they couldn't get into the garage at the parking thing and came in like 2 minutes later than your plane came in. I mean, it's so unfair to that person, and that hurts your relationship, takes a nick out of your relationship.
Yeah. And I think that it's so great to be, I mean, and one way that you get closer to someone, you know, and I discuss this in the book, is through self-disclosure. So let's say that you and Greg were in fairly early stages of dating and this happened. He was late picking you up at the airport and he could tell that you were not in a great mood to see him and that you were able to recognize why you were feeling that way and relate it to, you know, Farmington Community Center, that you could say, wow, you know, it's taking me a minute to get out of, you know, this kind of mood I got in because this reminded me of, and then relate the experience and say, but I know that has nothing to do with you. And so, you know, then I'm so happy to see you. This is, you know, it's great to be with you again, and be able to make that jump, you know, share that and then make that jump emotionally so that you're in the correct emotional space for the experience that's happening now and you're not bringing the past to the present and letting it ruin your present life and relationship.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the overshare zone because people can go a little far with this. So you give this tip, I love this actually, only disclose facts about yourself, when, where, what, who, and so on. Refrain from including any of your feelings. You're talking about early on. And when you do talk about feelings, talk about those in the past or the future. And then, but then when can you disclose your feelings in the moment when you've just started dating someone? When does that not become toxic and awful?
Well, I think that you don't want to immediately, I mean, we've all been in these situations where we've had someone reveal something too quickly, and it kind of ruins it. Like, it's hard to move on from that. It feels like you're way ahead of where you should be. Also, what makes people feel like they have to disclose so much early on is if you jump into bed with someone on the first date. I get why people do it, but it's really important to give time for things to develop. And if you can wait, then you'll find that you're much more objective and that you're not trying to make the situation and the relationship work because you already invested too much. You know, so you overshared either sexually or emotionally too early. And that also really feeds fear. Then you really feel like there's a lot on the line and you have a lot to lose. So part of self-disclosure is, you know, going slowly, making sure that the person you're disclosing information to is worthy of it. And you don't know that until you get to know them a little bit better. And it's really difficult for people to either hold back or to actually disclose information because if they've been hurt, they have probably been hurt with information that they've given another person. So it can make them feel incredibly vulnerable. So that's why in the book I did that kind of step-by-step guide. You know, some people know how to do it, but some people don't disclose enough, so the other person can't feel close to them, and they wonder why they're not having, you know, close relationships. They're not allowing for it. We've all been in those situations where you realize, I know nothing about this person. I keep getting together with them. I know nothing about them. And then other people, I know too much too soon, and it's uncomfortable. So you need to just pace properly. And I think that if we're driven by fear, we don't. You know, either we're holding back or, you know, we're withdrawing or maybe we're clinging. Maybe we're trying to move things along too quickly to get that certainty and to get out of the ambiguous area that everyone is so uncomfortable with.
Oh, I think that that is great, very wise advice. And I wanted to just add something. For people who have a problem with overshare, I suggest keeping first dates cheap, short, and local. So you really, you know, you have an hour, happy hour, and you leave. So then there's more of the onion to unpeel. So you haven't just stripped down, you don't get in bed with them on the first date, you don't give in to temptation. That's something you talk a lot about. We have only about a minute left, so maybe just add a little bit to that as our before we have to leave.
Well, I guess that one of the things I want to add is that I have a whole chapter on communicating well, and I think that that is often something that trips people up. You mentioned it earlier, but, you know, being a good listener and being able to, again, be in the moment and pay attention to what that person is really saying and not getting it mixed up with things that other people said from the past so that you're really in the moment and you're with yourself in the present and you're with the other person in the present. And I think that can be really transformative.
Yes, I think that that is really wise and important advice. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Michelle Skeen. Her book we've been discussing is Love Me, Don't Leave Me, Overcoming Fear of Abandonment and Building Lasting Loving Relationships. Michelle, thank you. This is such an informative and interesting show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I loved it.